I am joined on the line by Brian Stoddart, whose wonderful new book, The Palempore Predicament, which is the new Superintendent Lefano mystery, is out now. Brian, how are you today?
Hello, Stuart. Lovely to talk to you again.
It is indeed lovely to talk to you again, Brian, because, well, to fill in listeners who don't know all the technical details, how many bloody goes have we had at this? A lot.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And it's a pleasure to talk to you too, Brian. It is a pleasure to talk about this book because I love this book. I think this is...
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. That's great.
This is one of those books that if I could whip out a handful of copies and go, boing, here, read this, I would. I would make my students read this, but unfortunately, it doesn't really fit into my teaching curriculum, which is a pain in the bum. But that's not important. What is important is that the book's out. Now, can you tell us a little bit about it?
In this one, as you say, it's a follow-up to the first Lefano, set in colonial Madras in India in the early 1920s. He's a member of the Indian Police Service at a time when India is going through some fairly massive political protests in support of Indian nationalist ambition. And the British attitude itself in India is starting to harden. Lefano finds himself in the middle of all of this. He has some sympathy for the nationalist cause, but he's also got a great respect for law and order. So he's trying to navigate his way between those two sort of pressure points. At the same time, he's trying to develop this relationship that he has with an Anglo-Indian woman. And in British India, that's something of a no-no because mixed-race relationships are definitely frowned upon. And to complicate all of that, he has to unravel the murder of a notable Indian landed prince, who then, it turns out, is mixed up with some Chinese gangs in the IRA, and British and Indian military intelligence get involved. So it's all a little bit of a historical tour, I suppose, of some of the contours that happened not only in, I think, imperial politics in India, but global politics as well as a result of the changes following World War One. So it's a murder mystery, but it's also mixed up in political and social change, not only in India, but across the globe in some respects.
It's all those little facets that make this book amazing. It's got all the lovely little nuances that a good book should have. It's not just a period piece. It's not just a police procedural. You've injected life into it. It must be very rewarding for you to be able to write like this, to be able to sit down and go, I'm going to develop this character and I know what I'm doing.
Well, what's really rewarding, Stuart, is actually the sort of response that you've given it, because luckily and, you know, very pleasingly, the response to the second one so far has been that people really like the first book, but they like the second book even more. And I think it does have something to do with what you're saying, that it's got the... it is very strongly based in the actual historical evidence at the time, but I've tried very hard to sort of get that into a form that it matters to the story and it matters to the character development. And those things sort of bear upon the resolution of the story. And I'm delighted to say that the first Lefano has just had a really lovely review in the Hindu newspaper, which is the long-term English paper published in Madras, now called Chennai. And it was really positive about all the historical setting. So knowing that I've got a fair amount of that at command makes it easier, in a sense, to try and write out the storyline and the plot line and get the characters right, because I know I've got the historical platform is fairly sound. You always have to check on some of the details, but the fun bit in it is leaving in the historical details, I think, that actually make a difference either to help explain the character or the story, or simply to carry an atmosphere of what the city was like back in the 1920s. And it's not only satisfying, it's actually a lot of fun, because Madras, now called Chennai, as I've suggested to you before, is really one of my favourite places in the world. So it's good fun to be able to do it.
A lot of people have said to me, this is like the Raj Quartet, but better. The Raj Quartet is very, very cruel, and it has a wonderful villain, but it lacks all the background that this does. It seems to me that because you managed to include cricket, it feels more alive. Cricket is a huge part of Indian culture, from what I understand, and it must have been even more so at the time, because it was a way of breaking down class structures and things. Does it help that go ahead.
Yeah, in a lot of respects, first of all, thank you for the very positive comparison to Paul Scott. That's a huge thing to say, and I'm very grateful for that. The great thing about being a social historian, I think, Stuart, is that you're able to latch on to things that a lot of people otherwise ignore. And the cricket one is interesting because, in many respects, cricket at that point was still a way of dividing the European community from the Indian one. And the Indian attempts to get into the game they faced a tough job in trying to get traction. So at that stage, there was still a Europeans versus Indians annual match. The Madras Cricket Club was open only to Europeans, and there were one or two Indian pioneers trying to set up other clubs in the city. So the subtext in all of this is that what we think of as, say, leisure forms, cricket or whatever else it happened to be, were in fact just another way of drawing boundaries between the British and the local populations. And in that sense, those are the sort of things that you can add to build up the picture of the way in which that society really worked. And it was a very... It was hidebound in the sense that there was not much give and take between the official British community and the commercial European community and the Indian populations. And in fact, in British India, certainly in Madras, there was also a sort of line drawn between the official British position and the commercial one. They didn't particularly like each other on all occasions either, so it was a very stratified environment, and it was stratified by both class and colour.
Hmm. To a certain extent, I imagine that India still is. I don't know enough about it, but these books give me a lovely feeling to sort of go and look at it some more. I mean, I know it is nearly 100 years ago, but social changes take a hell of a long time to go through, and I imagine they're still there.
Oh, a lot of them are, and a lot of them have only really begun to break down in the last, say, 20 years. For example, the whole rise of what's now called Dalit politics in India, which is really the former untouchable caste sort of becoming a political force. That's really only been in the last 20 years or so. And as in all historical settings, I think, what was done and a little after still have some resonance now. And certainly in writing the book and in writing the first one, I've had in mind that some of the themes are in fact timeless. The poverty is timeless, social stratification is timeless. They change in dimension and scope and all the rest of it. But the fundamentals are still there. And the great thing about, I think, doing these stories is that I can think of the current context and in some ways pre-Foreman back in the 1920s, because there is a direct line of development. And in that case, particularly with the second book, I was concerned to try and build India into a, even and Madras even, into a slightly more global context, because it was in a global context. It wasn't just hermetically sealed off. And that meant that some of the pressures coming in onto southern India were from the outside as much as they were from Delhi or anywhere else. And that just adds up to a much more complex social environment than I think people might have imagined otherwise.
I love Le Fanu. He has depth. He is almost timeless. He could function as a modern policeman. But I understand that you can't keep writing these forever. He's going to have to retire one day. And I look at him and think, can you go backwards on this? Can we have early Le Fanu?
Well, I think we've got a little while to go before we get to that, Stuart, because I've calculated fairly carefully. He's currently, in this book, he's just turned 40. Now, I think when I go back and look at the Indian Police Service rules and the rules of engagement for Europeans in India, he's probably got about another 14 or 15 years to serve. So if I space him out adequately, there's scope for quite a few more novels yet before I have to start getting him either going into what would now be the cold case follow-up or doing the Endeavour series and writing the early Moore. So I don't think I have to get into that complication just yet. And the other good thing is that that would take him up until about the mid to late 1930s, which is when provincial government in India is handed over to Indians. So there's a lot of scope for all sorts of political and social changes to be tracked in the succeeding Le Fanu novel. So you can be reassured on that front.
That's good, because I think that if you were to go back and fill in all the background, it would probably suck some of the mystery out of it. It's a bit all this rewriting.
I wasn't particularly fond of the Endeavour series that goes back to the early Moore. So I could see the point of it, but it didn't quite work for me. And I think that's because you get a very formed view of what a person's like. And sometimes the earlier depiction doesn't really fit. I've found this much the same thing with the Montalbano going with Andrea Camilleri going back to write the first Montalbano case. That didn't quite work for me nearly as well as some of the other Montalbanos do. So maybe that's just me, I don't know.
No, I think it's a lot of pressure from within the publishing industry to, they want novels that are known quantities. They think that people should be reading nothing new. Are you finding that this is a problem within the industry at the moment?
Oh, look, I'm finding a very interesting divide. So when I did the first book, A Madras Miasma, which fortunately it's got some very, very nice reviews, and I'm very happy about that. I pitched this to some agents, all of whom liked it, but said that in their view it wasn't commercial, for which read, they didn't think it was an airport book or, you know, a mass seller that the big six publishers would pick up. And, you know, in some ways you think, oh, I think it's a bit better than that. But from their point, they know their industry and they know what they're trying to push out. And certainly I think what we're seeing now is a number of people coming through who've in effect been able to force a change on some of that sort of the bigger end of the publishing industry. There's a few people who've even started from self-publishing, sold, you know, hundreds of thousands of copies and then been picked up by one of the mainstream publishers and made commercials. But I do think your earlier point operates, where a lot of authors I know, I think, come under pressure to keep churning out similar sorts of books, and I think that shows in one or two of them. You know, there are some authors who I really like, who I've read some of the more recent things from in the last, say, 18 months or so, and I didn't really like them quite as much. I think it's just the pressure comes on a bit too much, and you know, they have to write more and more.
It's interesting you said that agents viewed your book as not being commercial or not being an airport book, and I'm thinking, this is why I like this book. It is not one of these horrible, big, bloody things that you get and you read it because you have no alternatives. I mean, maybe I'm jaded, maybe I am old-fashioned, but I believe that a reader should engage with a book primarily on the level of that they like the bloody thing and they're not just reading it for reading's sake. And that's why I think your work works well. That's why I think that a lot of the stuff that's coming out from Crime Wave Press impresses me so much, is that it is not formulaic pap targeted at people who like to be told what to read.
Look, I think there's a lot in that, and one of the great things about working with Crime Wave Press is that Tom Varda and Hans Kemp, you know, are very individualist people themselves, and they've got a very broad vision of what it is that they are prepared to publish, and a lot of it is stuff that probably wouldn't be published by the Big Six, as they keep saying. And in a way, it's great working with a smaller press, because I think you've got a lot more room to move and a lot more scope to do some things that perhaps you wouldn't be able to in a more court circumstance. I mean, terrific. Some of the big commercial house authors, I think, are great. I really love reading them. But there's also quite a number that I don't, and that's, again, down to personal choice. And if places like Crime Wave Press provide an option where you can actually go and read some other things, I'm all for it, and I'm very happy to be publishing with them, because, I don't see my work as being, in some respects, not radically different from some of the other stuff that appears with the bigger houses. And I think there is always an element of getting past the gatekeepers, whether it's agents or editors or whatever, in some of these things is perhaps a bit tougher. But I'm just really glad to have my books coming out in a way that people can access at a pretty reasonable price and really get access to something different.
Yeah, and it is... I do like this advent of internet presses. I know that sounds like a bloody strange expression, because it's hard to have the internet and a press. Either it's one or the other. But I like the idea that people have access to, instant access to cheap books that are not just being hammered down their throat. I mean, you have to go out of your way a bit to find Crime Wave Press. I was lucky. It sort of fell into my lap. But these smaller presses tend to attract authors that aren't all about the money. I think that's a key thing. I don't think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think you are writing these books to make a gallon of money. I think you're writing these books because you like writing them.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. And the other thing about it is it's fun to be in a sense on the ground floor of Crime Wave Press, because they're just a couple of years old now, 16 or 18 titles out already, a huge range of style and interest and location and all of that, and it's fun to be part of something and to grow with it. And that's something that you can't do either with the more established presses, where I know particularly the first-time authors sometimes feel that the level of intervention on what they write is fairly substantial. And luckily I haven't had to deal with that with Tom and Hans, because their view is that they want to get people writing. They want their authors to write with a kind of authentic voice and not a formulaic house style, which I think is what you're really pointing at, Stuart.
Mm.
And that just gives the writers amongst us the chance to really sort of develop a particular profile and a particular style and to work at the writing in a way that they want to without sort of undue direction. And for me, that's quite important because if there is any area where perhaps there's getting to be a sameness about some of the more broad stream offerings, it's probably around that formulaic structure that you're talking about, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. A couple of people have suggested to me lately that Le Fanu is in the mould of Foyle. I don't know if you're familiar with Foyle.
And, I am indeed.
And I thought, well, you're right. You know, if you do retire Foyle, and I know you're in New Zealand at the moment, would there be any chance... Sorry, if you do retire Foyle. If you do retire Le Fanu, if you retired Foyle, I'd be a bit worried. If you retire Le Fanu, is there a possibility that he could, you know, move out amongst the... Well, what would have been the Empire at the time, but move out amongst the Commonwealth countries and maybe end up as a, you know, as something in New Zealand or something in Australia, some way that you again have the background to write that would give the character the depth of the experience?
Oh, look, it is entirely possible because, as you know, in both the books so far, there's mention about what he might do if he does have to leave India. And certainly places like Australia and New Zealand are possibilities. And I think that adds, it gives him some options, and it gives me some options too. Because if I did get down the track a bit and thought, well, it might be time for a change of scenery earlier than that anticipated, yes, he can go to some of these other locations, and I think operate in much the same way, because, for example, I met a guy several years ago living in Perth in Australia who has actually started in the customs service in India and then gone to East Africa as independence and then ended up in Australia. So that movability about civil servants and people associated with the empire, not just from India but elsewhere, I think actually raises all sorts of possibilities for crime fiction alone. And it is a terrific thing having that historical knowledge and that historical background to enable me to add in, I think, some interesting diversions in some cases, but also some bigger opportunities if I need those further along the storyline.
Hmm. Well, Brian, you're in New Zealand at the moment, and you're probably having a great time. But what's coming up next for you? Are you working on anything at the moment, or are you just having a well-earned break?
Le Fanu 3 I've pretty much planned out. I'm doing this one slightly different from the second one, which was slightly different from the first. There's a little bit more planning gone into this one. And in fact, I'm hoping to start writing Le Fanu 3 probably in about a week or 10 days. And once I get going into that, I should have a full draft by early New Year, March, April, somewhere like that. So Le Fanu 3 is definitely on the move. And I've got a couple of other non-fiction things that I'm doing as well to keep me entertained. So, yeah, there's plenty of writing going on, Stuart, so and another Le Fanu is definitely in the offing.
In that case, Brian, we will talk again.
Oh, I look forward to that. It's good fun.
It's great fun. Look, Brian, thank you very much for taking time out of your... Well, what must be an incredibly busy writing schedule, basically. I can't even imagine drafting a book in a couple of months, let alone going, oh, yeah, I'll have it done by the early New Year. So,
Once I get going, I can write fairly quickly, and it's a result of many years of academic writing. But I also I've also done a lot of stuff for the press and radio and television as well. And in those circumstances, you learn to write quickly as well as relatively concisely. So I've been fortunate in the kind of background that I've had. And when I actually get to sit down and really start it, the other great thing about it is I love writing Lefanu because he, to me, he is a fun sort of person to play with. And the context in which he gets to operate is also something that fascinates me and has done for a long time and continues to do that. So it's the perfect combination, really.
Must be good to do what you like. That's all I can think.
it does have its moments, I can tell you.
Yeah. Well, Brian, thank you very much for joining us today, and we will catch up with you as soon as Crime Wave Press gets the next one out.
Thanks again, Stuart. Appreciate it.